How's that?
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our Bible class. We're in Romans chapter 1 to begin. If you would turn over there, please. Just to look at a quick verse as we launch into our study of Christian evidences in a minute. I want to take just a second and thank you for the energy you've invested into this study. I know it's tedious and challenging. It's challenging for me, and I want to just say thank you for your effort and your interest in the study as we go. I want to look at verse 25 for just a minute and remind ourselves of a very familiar passage where Paul is talking about those who are more interested in the creation than they are in the Creator. As a matter of fact, he says in verse 25 that there are those who have exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. There were some in Paul's day who worshipped the creation. They worshipped what was made, the physical universe, something therein, instead of worshiping and serving God. And so they stopped short dramatically of what they should have been doing, of what they should have recognized on the basis of the creation. The creation is supposed to lead us to some conclusion. So if you bounce up to verse 18 and 19, because we know that, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. In verse 20, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. And so there are those who, seeing the creation of God, seeing the tremendous design and balance and order in the universe, still nonetheless, for some reason, conclude that they should worship the creation and fail to recognize then the creature, the Creator. And that's a dramatic error, a dramatic missing of the mark there. There are those in history that we know about who worshipped the sun itself, those who worshipped rivers, who worshipped the changing of the seasons, who worshipped goddesses and gods of fertility and things like this, but who, like those Paul is talking about here, missed the point. They saw the creation, but they missed the point. They stopped there. They directed their worship there instead of recognizing the God who created all of those things. In Hebrews chapter 3, verses 3 and 4, we see the basis for why one should go from the creation to the Creator. Hebrews chapter 3, verses 3 and 4, for this one has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, talking about Jesus, inasmuch as he who built the house has more honor than the house. For every house is built by someone, he who built all things is God. So the builder of the house, the Hebrews writer says, should have more honor than the house. And that's a self-evident observation. So as we study arguments for the existence of God, we are in the argument to design, the argument that studies, looks at the universe, and asks the question, is it reasonable to conclude that design exists? Is it more reasonable to conclude that design exists than that the universe is random, that there are no direction, there is no direction or purpose or goal or intention, intelligent intention behind it? What's more reasonable to conclude? So the argument looks like this. If there are objects in the universe, in the physical universe, that exhibit order and arrangement, then there is design. And that is almost beyond question. If there is a sufficiently complex object, or a sufficiently complex collection of objects that work together to accomplish some goal, then they must have been put there by design. Really, that's inherent in the word sufficient. The second issue, and that's where we are now, is to decide whether or not there are objects that exhibit order and arrangement. So as we look out in the universe, and this involves a study of the world, we call it science, but we could call it whatever we want to. We're studying the world, studying the creation, observing the creation that God has placed us in. Is it reasonable to conclude one more so one way or the other? And if we can decide that there's order and arrangement in the world, then this argument leads to the existence of a designer. Okay, and we talked about that last time. Okay, so there are three arenas of design that we're studying here. The first we looked at last week, this had to do last week with the fine-tuning of the fundamental laws that govern physics, interactions between fundamental particles and forces that constitute the working of our physical universe. You can think of this, I think of this as the foundation of the earth that the psalmist talks about and others. Whenever we look around at us, at the universe, there is a foundational platform on which everything in the universe depends, and that is these fundamental laws of physics. Chemistry depends on the fundamental laws of physics. Life, therefore, being a part of chemistry and biology and so forth, depends on these fundamental laws of physics. And we saw last time that those laws are very finely tuned, even tuned beyond our ability to comprehend, as if someone must have paid attention to setting these fundamental laws in place. They could have been different, it seems, but it looks as though someone has finely tuned them. Okay. So in the second place today, we want to get into the non-living realm. And there's kind of a progression here. The fine-tuning of the fundamental laws of physics gives us a platform on which the universe can operate. And then on top of that, we have atoms and molecules and more complex molecules. But those live in, at least at the first level, the non-living realm. There is no life in a stone, although a stone involves a number of minerals and molecules and so forth. And so the non-living realm is where we'll spend our time today. After that, we'll go up a level of complexity to talking about life. Life in the living realm will show up there. So as we study now the non-living realm, I want to go back to the sun for a few minutes. We've talked about the sun before. And we've talked about the immense amount of energy that it puts out. Okay, so we're coming to the solar system. The universe is much bigger than the solar system, if you believe your telescope. Okay, but the solar system that we live in is centered around the sun. The sun itself accounts for over 99% of the stuff, of the matter in the solar system. So the sun is vastly massive compared to the planets, for example, compared to the moons that go around the planets and so forth. Well over 99%, it's over 99.5%, according to estimates, the matter in the solar system is in the sun itself. Now what the sun does for us is a couple of things. We'll start off talking about the energy that it puts out, but it actually does a lot more. It keeps us gravitationally stable. So it keeps us in an orbit, and it does that for all of the planets. But let's talk just for a minute about the energy that the sun puts out. The sun converts, by nuclear fusion, some 650 million tons of hydrogen into helium every second of every day, of every week, of every year. 650 million tons of hydrogen are converted into helium by a nuclear reaction. Now, nuclear fusion is different from the kind of nuclear reaction that you have in an atomic bomb. So an atomic bomb is not as powerful, okay, suffice it to say, is not as powerful as nuclear fusion. Fusion is a stronger reaction even than the kind of reaction in such a bomb. But the sun takes 650 million tons and converts it into helium, converts it by nuclear fusion every single second. And the word consistently there is important, I think. What if from 1 minute to the next or 1 hour to the next, the sun is maybe dropping off its energy output or maybe increasing its energy output by 10 or 20 or 30% of its like average value? What kind of consequences would that have for life on Earth? The sun consistently is generating energy that fuels and powers the solar system, in particular life on Earth. You might think of the sun as the heartbeat of the solar system. On the surface of the sun, it is estimated to be, and again, I am taking someone's word for this, okay? But the surface of the sun is at 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit, or slightly there under, about 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. But at its core, where this nuclear fusion occurs, the temperature is believed to be around 27 million degrees Fahrenheit, if you can even imagine, if we can even fathom such a temperature. Okay, my wood stove gets up to maybe 600 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay, so 27 million degrees Fahrenheit is the core of the sun. The core accounts for about 20-25% of the center of the sun there, and then from that point out, energy is radiated to the surface where it reaches about 10,000 degrees. So an enormous amount of energy is put out by the sun. Why does that matter? How does that affect us? Well, for one thing, our distance to the sun is finely positioned. If we were much further from the sun, scientists estimate a 10% change. Further away from the sun, life would be impossible. If we were 10% closer to the sun, scientists estimate, maybe not even that much, but on the order of 10%, life would be impossible. Not just what we're doing today, but even simple life at the cellular level, single cellular level, life would be impossible if we were much different in distance to the sun, given the amount of energy that it puts out. We need energy, but not too much. To kind of illustrate this and the issue that's involved, think about what happens in the wintertime. So in the wintertime, we're tilted, we'll talk about this later, but we're tilted on our axis away from the sun, so that the sun hits where we live in Moundsville, West Virginia, more tangentially than it does in the summertime. It's not that we're not getting any sunlight at all, it's that it's arriving in a somewhat tangential way relative to what it does in the summertime. Small changes can have drastic, even devastating results. So no life would be possible if the distance were much different than what it is. But there's much more than just the distance involved in our position relative to the sun. So the rate of rotation of the Earth is what determines how long our days are. If the rate of rotation were sped up, what would that mean? What if we had shorter days, and the Earth were spinning faster than it is? Well, we'd have less daylight hours, less opportunity for plants to grow, and so forth. And so the rate of rotation is very, very important. If it were much slower, you would have extremes of heat and cold. The side of the Earth facing the sun would get too hot. The side of the Earth facing away from the sun would be too cold, as is illustrated on the other planets that have different rates of rotation. So for example, Venus rotates at a rate of one time every 200 Earth days. So Venus is rotating very, very slowly, and its temperatures run up into the hundreds of degrees Fahrenheit on the side of Venus facing the sun. So the rate of rotation is very important there. But also the rate of revolution. As the Earth travels around the sun, what we call a year, if that were much different, the seasons would change in length. So if the Earth were going faster around the sun, then the seasons would be shorter than they are. If the Earth were going more slowly, the opposite would be the case. And so all of these things are balanced in a way that's remarkable and demands an explanation. The shape of the orbit is determined up to a point. So gravitational forces between two massive objects have to be elliptical. So those are the only options, but ellipses come in many shapes and sizes. So the object there on the left is an ellipse. It's also a circle. But the object on the right is a possible orbit, and some orbits take more elongated shapes like this. What if Earth's orbit happened to be more like the one on the right than it is like the one on the left? What would that mean for life on Earth? The sun would be in one of the extremes. Looking at the image on the right would be, say, for example, over to the left edge of the ellipse, tucked kind of in the corner, and the Earth would speed far away from it, and then come back to be very close to the sun. So if the Earth's orbit were much different than it is, that would have significant consequences for the existence of life on Earth. And so the Earth's parameters and the way that they're tuned in relation to the sun are extremely important for life to be able to exist at all. And so the question we have to ask is, what's the explanation for this balancing act? In the last place you see here, these markers are not independent from one another. So the distance to the sun is correlated to, and we'll talk more about this later, is correlated to the rate of revolution. And so the length of a year depends on how far you are from the sun. The closer you are to the sun, your rate of revolution must be much shorter, must be larger, so that your year is much shorter. And if you're far from the sun, the opposite must be the case. But the sun gives off a fixed amount of energy. And so that distance and that rate of revolution are correlated in a very precise way. But let's talk a little more about the sun's energy. So the sun gives off enormous amounts of energy, and that's great for life. Every aspect of our existence depends on the sun's energy. But uncontrolled energy is dangerous, deadly, devastating. So the sun gives off enormous amounts of energy in the form of ultraviolet radiation. And we know about this because we buy sunglasses specifically designed to filter out harmful rays from reaching our eyes. Ultraviolet radiation is in the form of X-rays and gamma rays and others. So these are rays that are like light. Light is in what's called the visible spectrum, but higher energy radiation is above the visible spectrum in frequency. And so these are high energy, dangerous rays that are devastating, damaging to life. Well, that's bad. Why are we able to survive? Well, because the Earth has been fitted with an ozone layer far up above the surface of the Earth in what's called the mesosphere. This ozone sits there. It's a compound of oxygen, and it sits there and protects us from these rays in such a way that the ozone is not destroyed in the process. So a high-energy ray comes in, interacts with an ozone molecule. The molecule is changed, but then quickly changes back to its pre-interaction state so that it's ready for the next one and so is not damaged in the process. So the Earth's ozone protects us from ultraviolet radiation to the point where life can exist. Okay? And so we have to ask, why is that there? How did that get there? We need this energy from the sun, but we don't need the harmful aspects of the energy. Okay? There's a mechanism to deal with the harmful aspects. How do you explain that the presence of such a mechanism? Another aspect of the sun's energy that's dangerous is called solar wind, which are charged particles that shoot outward away from the sun and come toward the Earth. They emanate in all directions, and some of those particles would hit the Earth. It's believed that these particles would, if they were allowed to hit the Earth and interact with our atmosphere, would strip our atmosphere away from the Earth. Have you ever wondered why it is that there's an atmosphere to begin with? Why couldn't the Earth just end with the ground, and then above the ground, there's no air, no oxygen, nothing, there's no reason for it to be there necessarily, except that it is maintained by several of these mechanisms. So these particles would come into the Earth, interact with the atmosphere, and damage it, even remove it, fling the atmosphere out into space piece by piece, you could imagine, if it were not for the magnetic field that radiates outward from the Earth's center. So the Earth has a magnetic field, as you know. This is why our compasses work, why we can navigate using a compass. And that magnetic field extends thousands of miles out into space and interacts with these incoming dangerous particles, these protons and electrons. And so the magnetic field, and I have a picture of it here, okay, and this is an open source image.
And you can see the sun.
The sun's what's called the solar wind, these charged particles coming in from the left and interacting with the Earth's field in a way that protects and deflects those particles. Without this field, it's believed by scientists that no atmosphere could persist. Why is it, for example, that on Mars there is no atmosphere? We've sent probes there, we've sent rovers there, and we know there is no atmosphere. Why is there no atmosphere? We know on the moon there is no atmosphere to speak of. Why is that? The Earth is a glob of stuff out in space going around the sun just like these other objects, and it happens to have an atmosphere. Is that an argument for the existence of God? Is it a proof of the existence of God? No, I suppose it's not. But taken in total, all of these issues have to be dealt with, have to be brought into a framework that explains why these things work, why we are able to survive on Earth. But let's move on from the sun. A lot more could be said about it. Perhaps you know of other interesting coincidences and other interesting illustrations of design relative to the sun. But I want to move on to talking now about the Earth a little more in detail. So the Earth, as you know, is tilted on its axis approximately 23.5 degrees, and that's relative to the plane that we spin around the sun in. So the Earth is at some angle. If it were at a 0-degree angle to the orbital plane, if the Earth's axis were made no angle with the axis of the orbital plane, we would have never-ending summertime at the equator, and we would have extreme cold temperatures at the poles. And so there would be extremes all over the place if it weren't the way that it is, or something close to the way that it is. The reason we have seasons, as you understand, is that as the Earth goes around the sun, so imagine the sun is at some fixed point here, the Earth is tilted, and as we come over to one side, there is a side of the Earth, or a hemisphere of the Earth, that comes a little closer to the sun. It receives the sun's rays more directly than it does when it's at the opposite position, so the axis doesn't rotate as it goes around, so the Earth comes to the other side, and now the northern hemisphere in my picture here is now more tangentially receiving energy from the sun, rays from the sun. But you should think about, and we should think about, why that tilt is present. Why is it roughly what it is? What if it were a little bit different? So again, a 0-degree tilt would be the scenario where the sun is fixed, and the axis, the spinning axis of the Earth is perpendicular to the plane of orbit. And so it's standing up in this way. In this case, the equator is always getting direct sun, direct energy from the sun. As you go away from the equator, moving toward either the north or south pole, the energy from the sun hits more tangentially up to a point where at the north pole you have something like no energy reaching the Earth. And so the same would be true at the south pole. If there were a 0-degree tilt, the Earth would cook at the equator, presumably. Okay, we can't run that experiment, but it would cook at the equator and absolutely freeze at the poles. But what if there were a 90-degree angle between the plane and the axis of the Earth? In that case, the Earth would be going around the sun, spinning about my finger here. Okay, so in one extreme, the North Pole would receive direct energy from the sun. Okay, it would absolutely bake for months and months in this configuration, but then when it came to the other side of the sun, the North Pole would receive absolutely no energy from the sun for months and months on end. And that would be devastating for life on Earth. The extremes in temperature would be impossible to cope with. Remember, the Earth has to go around the sun at a certain pace. It has to spin at a certain pace. And this angle of tilt has to be within a reasonably acceptable region of tilt. And so that's significant for us. Secondly, at the equator, the Earth is rotating at a high rate of speed, at least what sounds like a high rate of speed, 1,000 miles per hour. Now, the Earth is large, and so even at that pace, it takes one day, what we define to be a day, to rotate exactly one time. But what if that were a little higher? 1,000 is a large number, but why couldn't it be a little bit higher, or a little bit smaller, or much smaller, or much larger? It's right around 1,000 miles per hour. Think about the benefit, and if you've done any gardening, you know in August in particular, or even into September, July, during the hot months of the summertime, plants are repairing at night. And so the plants can endure. They need the sunlight energy during the day, throughout the heat of the day. The plants, though, are broken down and somewhat damaged by the energy of the sun. At nighttime, they are able to rebuild and repair themselves and so be ready for the next day of energy. Plants need a certain period of repair. They also need a certain period of exposure to the sun. And so there's a balancing act that's going on here. Animals need a rest period. And so during the nighttime, we can rest. If the daylight extended much longer than it does, perhaps complex life would not be able to adequately rest, would be at least affected by that change. And so the rate of the Earth's rotation is important. For these reasons, and probably for other reasons that other people know that I don't know, and for other reasons that maybe nobody knows. Okay, and so there is incredible balancing here that's going on. The length of the seasons and the distance from the sun are highly correlated. We mentioned this earlier. And so the further you are from the sun, the longer the orbital period has to be, that is how long it takes to go once around the sun, has to be to maintain a stable orbit. Mercury goes around the sun very quickly. That affects the year for Mercury. Mercury's year is therefore very short. The Earth's year is what it is because of, at least correlated to, its distance from the sun. So if the Earth were much further away, or any further away, its orbital period would be different. And that's true all the way out to Neptune and Pluto. So if I make a change to one, there has to be a change to the other one. But if the amount of output from the sun is what it is fixed, okay, of course that could be different from what it is, but if it's fixed at some, if we set that variable and then think about changing the other variables, we have to deal with this correlation, okay, which is written into the laws of physics, which goes back to what we talked about last time. And so all of these things and many others are related to one another and cannot be willy-nilly jiggled or changed by very much at all. So this term Goldilocks region has been used by lots of people to describe the situation that the Earth finds itself in, that we find ourselves in. Why is it that things work, given that many, many parameters have to be matched up with one another for life to be possible in the first place? Okay, any questions or comments or thoughts about that? Ideas? Okay, so let's move on. From outer space now, we've gone from the solar system to the Earth, and now let's zoom in a bit on the Earth. From outer space, you can see that the Earth is blue. It appears to be blue to at least to some extent. Maybe a little bit of white mixed in there as well, but it's blue because of the water that covers the surface of the Earth. The Earth is covered in roughly 70% water, that is 70% by area of the Earth's surface is water. Most of that's in the oceans. And the average depth of the oceans is over 12,000 feet. So imagine that. 70% of the planet is covered in water. The depth of the oceans varies, but the average is over 12,000 feet. So that's over 2 miles deep. Over 2 miles of water is on the surface of the Earth. That's an incredible volume of water. In my mind, I contrast this with the sorts of conversations and sorts of things you hear about when you read about like the Mars rover or these other things that go out and explore other bodies in the solar system, moons and so forth, when they talk about looking for trace elements of water. Is there any water on Mars? Is there any water on the moon? Is there any water on Saturn's moons and so forth? And you look, they look not directly for water, they look for traces that maybe water was there at one time. Maybe they say it's far too cold for liquid water to exist, but you know, we're looking for indications of water. By contrast, our planet is literally covered with water. What's special about water? Why is water important? Could we replace that water with something like rubbing alcohol or some other liquid substance? Would that work? From an energy perspective, water has what's called a very high specific heat, which means something very simple. It means that it takes a lot of energy to heat water up, and that a lot of energy is given off whenever water cools down. We know this because it takes a long time to boil water. Water takes a lot of energy. It has one of the highest specific heats, and is Reed here? Reed is not here. Reed is a chemist, as you know, and he can tell you a lot more about this. But water has one of the highest specific heats of any liquid that occurs naturally. So that's interesting. What that does is keeps our temperature stable as we go through space, which is on the order of 400 degrees outer space below zero on the Fahrenheit scale. So water is helping keep our temperature stable. You say, sometimes I'm cold and sometimes I'm hot. Why no? But we, if you think about it, we still live in a very narrow range of possible temperatures, and water is part of keeping those things relatively stable. We use water in purposes that make this actually obvious. In your car, you use water in the radiator to help keep the engine temperature under control. Why is it? Well, antifreeze is mixed in there, but a lot of that is water. Why is that? Because whenever antifreeze comes in contact with cool antifreeze, comes in contact with a hot object, it absorbs a lot of the heat and then carries it away to be dissipated. And so temperature stability is a major, major function of water. If our Earth is covered 70% to a depth of approximately, or on average, 12,000 feet with water, that has an enormous stabilizing effect to the temperature of the Earth. Furthermore, water is highly resistant to boiling and freezing. It has what's called a high heat of vaporization and a high surface tension, which keeps it stable. You know, it's a stabilizing feature. Imagine if that were less the case, if it were less true that water resists boiling. What would that cause? Well, the oceans are always evaporating. Water evaporates out of the oceans and forms clouds, as we know, and then that carries rain to the rest of the Earth. If that process were changed, more water would evaporate. Evaporation is just a controlled form of boiling. And so if more water were vaporizing, the Earth could be subdued with an almost constant rain. Whereas if it were less likely, the water would tend to stay more in the oceans, causing rain to be less common. And so there's a balancing act between the chemical makeup, the chemical properties of water, and how it interacts with life on Earth. Water is special, though, and I was hoping Reed would be here and could make a comment about this. But if you look at where water falls in the periodic table, I know it's not on the periodic table, but water is a compound of hydrogen with oxygen. And if you look in the column underneath of oxygen, there are other elements, and I've listed some of them here. Hydrogen forms compounds with these elements in that same column of the periodic table. Starting at the bottom, you have hydrogen telluride, if I'm pronouncing that right, which has these boiling and freezing points. They're very low relative to the boiling point and freezing point of water. So hydrogen telluride at most, certainly at room temperature, would be in a gaseous form because it would have boiled out by the time it gets up to around 25 degrees Celsius. Hydrogen selenide is another compound of hydrogen. Notice how narrow the range is between the boiling and freezing points of selenide, hydrogen selenide. There's a difference of just some 20 degrees Celsius between when the substance boils and when it would freeze. Same is true of hydrogen sulfide. Again, slightly elevated, slightly depressed, boiling and freezing points, but still very narrow band there showing up. Water is the next in this list. That would be hydrogen oxide, moving from the bottom toward the top of the periodic table. What we would expect, not knowing anything else, is that that trend would continue. Namely, the boiling and freezing temperatures would get lower, and the distance between them would get smaller. Okay, so they would freeze and boil at lower temperatures, and they would freeze and boil at temperatures that are more closely related. But that's the opposite of what we find. As a matter of fact, when you make that single step from sulfide up to oxide, the boiling and freezing points go up dramatically, and the distance between them increases dramatically. Why is that? Well, that has to do with the fundamental chemical properties of what happens when two hydrogen atoms join up with an oxygen atom. And I don't claim to understand that. But it does happen, and its consequences for life on Earth cannot be overstated. At the temperature where we find ourselves, most of the water on the surface of the Earth is in liquid form. And that's important for life to exist. Now again, the temperature range where we find ourselves depends on the sun and our distance to the sun and the way we go around the sun and the fact that we have an atmosphere that holds heat in and all of these other parameters so that liquid water can exist. Water, as we said, has a high surface tension and heat of vaporization. It is, as we said, relatively slow to evaporate, a less stable compound. Even of hydrogen would maybe evaporate much more quickly, which would affect the water cycle enormously. Fifth, the solid state of water, as you know, does the opposite of what the solid states typically do, which is sink. So ice floats on top of its liquid form. That is very uncommon, very strange to occur. But it's also absolutely necessary for water-dwelling life. Imagine what would happen if, whenever water got cooler and cooler and cooler and froze, if that solid form were to sink to the bottom of the pool or the pond or the ocean. If the ice sank to the bottom and more ice kept piling up on top of it, eventually the fish would be forced out and the water-dwelling life would be forced out of the water and would be affected. What actually happens is when water cools and forms ice, that ice expands a little bit, causing it to float so that the water underneath it can continue to be water. And anything that freezes will freeze and float to the top. The fish can still live underneath of it. The effect of that ice then on top of the water is also insulating. So it protects and holds in heat for the life underneath of it. And so that's extremely important for the existence of life, which depends on water. Also, water is a universal solvent, which means, again, if Reed were here, he could tell us more about this. Water is a solvent, which means that it, whenever it interacts with other molecules and compounds, because of its strong electrical differential from one side of the molecule to the other, it tends to pull other atoms and molecules toward itself, thus breaking them down. And so it tends to break down many chemicals and many substances as it interacts with them. A consequence of this is that as water travels, as it flows down streams and rivers and so forth, it is able to carry minerals and substances that are necessary for life downstream. It's also able in our bodies to carry chemicals and minerals and substances throughout our bodies and to help keep them dissolved as they need to be and to help transport them as they need to be transported. And so all of these things point to an enormously special substance that we know every day as water. And we're particularly interested in water today, aren't we? because the water is out. I was asked to make an announcement, and that slipped my mind. I apologize about that. The water is out, as most of you know, and so we're asked not to flush the toilets or to try to use any water until that issue is resolved. So water is a universal solvent. Any questions or thoughts about what we've talked about so far? Okay, we're almost out of time. We have about 4 minutes. I hope we have 4 minutes. And I want to just, we'll stop here. There's so much more that we could say about the inorganic realm, the non-living realm, that we are a part of. Our bodies live in the physical realm. We are life, but the things that make up our body are themselves individually non-living. What can we say about this? The question that we need to ask when we're talking about these issues with others, studying them ourselves even, is at what point have we reached so many coincidences that no longer can chance be offered as a reasonable explanation? At what point does that occur? So we've talked about the solar system itself and the Earth's configuration and water, let's say, on Earth. And we could talk about dozens of other aspects of the non-living realm alone. So at what point do these coincidences reach a level where we would say randomness, chance happenings cannot explain these coincidences? When does that happen? Does it happen at this point or at this point or at this point? At what point do I have to reject randomness and infer design? And that's our objective. There's an analogy to that question, thinking about the resurrection. And we're going to talk about the resurrection later on in our class. But when we think about the resurrection, a falsification of Christianity, a way to falsify Christianity, would be to say, if you can show me the bones of the Lord, the grave of Jesus with his body, if you could show me that, now I realize that's a lot to ask, okay, but if you could show that to be the case, I would have to reject Christianity. It cannot be realistic. It cannot be reasonable. It cannot be the truth. It doesn't correspond to reality. Okay? In the same way, someone who holds that randomness is the explanation for all of these things and so many others that we could talk about has to be asked the question, at what point could you falsify the assumption of randomness? What would it take? What would I have to show you for you to say, okay, you've now shown me enough evidence, I reject randomness, and I come over to the side of undeniable design? That's an important question. Our beliefs should be and are, in the case of Christianity, falsifiable. And so we need to think about that and study it to the best of our abilities. We are out of time now, so we'll wrap things up there. Thank you for your attention. Next week, we will get into the living realm and discuss aspects of biology that point to design. Thank you very much.